I don't know. This latest news from Iraq does seem to be at least signal an opening of a new phase. What's going on over there? Of course, I'm talking about those church bombings. Four churches bombed simultaneously, and then the news is they found a fifth bomb at a fifth church. They were able to defuse that before it went off. And these are Christian churches in Iraq, both in Mosul and the majority of them in Baghdad. We're going to start out talking about that with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International, here in the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment. We'll go on to do some other subjects with Uwe during our religion roundup in this 25 minutes. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. 1 hour from now, we're going to start open lines for your questions and your comments. The last live hour of open lines this week. Our week is a little odd because my producer is doing a little traveling. Tomorrow we'll still be doing a live program. Thursday will not be a live program. So usually we wait until Thursday, give you a little bit of open lines there on Thursday for the last live hour. This week it's coming here. Tuesday in the last hour of today's program, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. There's some new research out that says that the Protestant majority in the United States will be soon a thing of the past. Not now, but will be soon a thing of the past. Also, George Gallup Jr. is retiring. He, of course, is the famous pollster. There's a column by Terry Mattingly who talks about some of the reflections of George Gallup on religion on the American landscape. We'll be talking about that during Open Lines as well. Uwe Simonetto is our guest for the Religion Roundup. He joins us from France. He's religion editor for United Press International and joins us as usual. Uwe, welcome back.
Hello, Todd. Wonderful to be here.
Uwe, this story about the church bombings in Baghdad and Mosul, give us a rundown of the story, and does this signal a new phase in what Islamic terrorists are willing to do, at least in that country?
Well, they planted car bombs at these churches at service time. 11 people were killed, about 55 injured, including Muslims and, of course, many Christians. The fascinating thing about this is that it absolutely violates instructions of the Prophet Muhammad, who in the 7th century A.D., issued what is called a firman or a firman, a letter of protection for Assyrian Christians. They were to be left in peace. Well, these people, obviously an Al-Qaeda linked organization, which stated that this was against the Crusaders, and all the evidence seems to point in the direction that what they're trying to do is here is make a statement. This is Muslim territory. Christians have no business being here.
Now, I'm wondering about this letter of tolerance or letter of protection
right. For
Assyrian Christians. This isn't just something that happens to be found in history. This is from the Prophet himself, isn't it?
Oh, yes. This is from the Prophet himself, who was very, very impressed with the scientific and the knowledge in the natural sciences and especially in medicine of the Assyrians. Now, we're talking about people here who actually spoke the language of Jesus or a dialect of the language of Jesus, Aramaic, and who traced their lineage back to ancient Mesopotamia, one of the oldest civilizations in human history. And these people had an enormously high level of education and learning. Muhammad was evidently very impressed by that and issued this firman, which disappeared in the mid-19th century during the Ottoman Empire, of course, and is understood to have been actually destroyed by the Ottomans just before they launched their genocidal attacks against Christians, not just against the Armenians. We know that by 1915 they murdered 1 million or 1.7 million Armenians, there are varying figures, but also 250,000 of these Assyrians. And the first ones to be murdered, the first mass slaughter of Christians occurred, again, shortly after the disappearance of that letter of protection in the mid-19th century.
So what is the status? I mean, I know that the document no longer exists. You just mentioned that. But what is the status of tolerance for Christianity? If one could, and it's hard to say this, of course, generally about Islam, as diverse as it is, but is the general sense in Islam among the clerics that Christianity, in the case that we find it here in Iraq, is to be tolerated and to serve under some sort of protection by the Muslim populace?
Well, that is what that is has been in the last 1,400 years the situation in most of the Islamic countries, that Christians and Jews were to live in what is called a dhimmi status. Dhimmi is a sort of subordinate status. They have a freedom of worship, but they had to pay extra taxes, and of course they were not allowed to own land and property and these things. But in this particular case, Muhammad stipulated that they were to be allowed everything. Basically, we know that that Islam does not tolerate a permanent existence of dhimmis, of subordinates. I mean, the ultimate goal is to Islamize the entire world. Obviously what we're seeing here is the work, clearly not of the mainstream Muslim groups, but the only ones that seem to be able to articulate some beliefs, and these are these radicals.
Two final questions on that subject, Uwe. Yeah. What is the intended message of those who would have planted these car bombs near Christian churches in Iraq?
Get out. Get out or succumb. That is the intended message. Go, and of course, you know, the Assyrians, there are about 700,000 left in Iraq, but 1.5 million worldwide. They're scattered all over the world like the Jews, and they're living in the, and the intent is really for these people to clear out and make Iraq a purely Islamic state.
According to the latest news I've been tracking this morning, there does seem to be at least the beginning of a rather large exodus from Iraq of Christians.
Sure.
They're going to neighboring countries where they feel like they might have a little more protection. What will this mean for Iraq?
Well, ultimately it will mean for Iraq that that unless moderate Muslims have the guts to take over, then it's going to be a radical Muslim country. It is it's not going to be a country of freewheeling, of religious freedom and that sort of thing, as it is intended and has been intended by the United States, for example, as they invaded Iraq, or indeed by the Iraqi opposition that was involved in that war.
It's been just a few days, more than a month, since sovereignty was handed over by the coalition forces. How do you assess the situation so far, just a month out?
Well, I'm not there, but it strikes me that this is going to be a very long, drawn-out process. I wouldn't despair over it. I mean, I just hope that the West is going to stay the course there, and as will be the Iraqis. But I mean, the problem is that that radical forces always seem to be able to win out, because especially among religious people, the moderates don't speak up.
On the American front, you've also written recently about a recent survey of American values and what Americans believe with regard to things like the posting of the Ten Commandments or religious tolerance. Tell us about what you discovered, Uwe.
Yeah, this is quite fascinating. This is a poll taken by the Barna Group out in California, and it goes to show that by and large, three-quarters of all Americans affirm basic American, basic Christian values. They are all in favor of leaving the Ten Commandments in place. Only 18% of the population supported the removal, for example, of the Ten Commandments down in Alabama, the Alabama Supreme Court. It's quite fascinating that, and strangely enough, the people who seem to be now in quotation marks, because I don't like that term applied here, but liberal, in other words, more secular, more Catholics seem to be secular than Protestants. Interestingly enough, even among the atheists and agnostics, there is a majority in favor of basic Christian values or Judeo-Christian values.
Also, you note there's a point of interest with regard to Roman Catholics and their view on the public display of the commandments. What is that?
Well, as I said, there were about 18%, like the general population, were in favor of removing the Ten Commandments. But the interesting part here is, you know, these 18%, if you look at the general population, that includes agnostics and everybody else and non-Christians, whereas the Catholics, as one Christian body, achieve the same percentage points. So in other words, among the Catholics, there is a much, much higher rate of people in favor of removing the Ten Commandments or in favor of or caving into secular demands than there is among Protestants, which I find quite troubling. And Catholic friends of mine, a priest friend, for example, said, well, this just seems to show that the Catholics have bought into the fallacious notion that one must not give offense to anyone. In other words, one must not give offense to non-believers by affirming the Ten Commandments. And as he said, the point is that Christianity will always offend some people, which is a very biblical notion. That is very troubling in a sense, because one had always thought that the Catholics might could be counted upon to be stronger supporters of basic Christian values.
And one other thing in that Barna survey, I'm looking at the actual results right now, and
right.
One thing I did not expect to see, but then it doesn't surprise me now upon reflection, support for making Christianity the official religion of the United States. What did Barna discover there?
Yeah, that is very odd. I mean, that 10 million Americans, they still are a minority, but still 10 million Americans are supportive of the idea of an amendment declaring Christianity the official religion, national religion. That is stunning, even though they are not the majority, they're about 60% or whatever, but they're not the majority of the American population. Still, 70 million Americans are in favor of that. And I find this, from everything compared with all previous polls that I've read, I find this quite remarkable. So there is a rather sturdy Christian faith afoot in the United States.
Turning to the more particular view of some of the mainline Protestant denominations, they seem to be across the board in decline, with a few notable exceptions.
Right.
Roman Catholicism, of course, not included there, but not on the decline. Southern Baptist Convention is not on the decline, and some smaller Presbyterian denominations also not on the decline. The largest one that you talked about recently in a commentary, the Presbyterian Church USA, what does its decline look like, and how do you account for it?
Well, the decline, this is, you know, since 1967, the Presbyterian Church USA has declined from 4.2 million members to 2.4 million now. And as you mentioned, there are smaller Presbyterian, conservative Presbyterian groups that have the opposite development. For example, the conservative Presbyterian Church in America now counts 350,000 faithful. That's up from some 60,000 when this group broke away from the Presbyterian Church USA in 1972. There's a similar development. The PCA, Presbyterian Church in America, is a southern denomination, essentially, or started out as a southern denomination, but there is a northern equivalent, the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, which has, again, skyrocketed from 15,000 in 1982 to 100,000 members. The decline is always kicks in. This is, by the way, a worldwide trend that applies to Europe and other parts of the world as well. Where a denomination espouses a secular or anthropocentric, man-centered, quote, theologies, unquote, where they do not preach the gospel, they start to decline very rapidly. Where, on the other hand, the gospel is preached correctly and where the sermons are Bible-centered, teachings are Bible-centered and confessional, especially among people like Presbyterians and Lutherans who are confessional denominations, number of faithful increases. The interesting thing with the Presbyterian Church USA is, for example, that whereas the entire denomination is in steep decline, the same thing is true, of course, for the Episcopal Church, the confessional groups within that same denomination are on the rise. So what you will have in the end is a falling away of, if you will, unfaithful Presbyterians, and then, of course, you might have a kernel of faithful Presbyterians that survive. I mean, for example, the confessional movement that started from nothing and now accounts for, I don't know, about 400,000 or 500,000 Presbyterians.
We're talking with Uwe Simonetto during our Religion Roundup here on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Uwe is religion editor for United Press International and is joining us this afternoon from France. One of the little footnotes on the Presbyterian Church USA is an action that it recently took, an official action it recently took, vis-a-vis Israel and the Palestinian situation. What did they do?
Yeah, they decided, or their General Assembly voted with an overwhelming majority to divest in Israel, you know, and they took a cue from their actions, and not very, very wise actions, I don't believe, either, in other parts of the world by American and Western universities and other institutions, churches, to divest in South Africa, never mind the suffering of the people, or specifically egregious, particularly egregious in places like Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, where the economy was destroyed, and what you found instead is is of course a fierce tyrannical dictatorship, which replaced, by the way, in places like Zimbabwe, for example, didn't replace a segregationist regime, but it replaced a regime run by a black Methodist bishop called Mutsureva. In this particular case, now they want to divest in Israel, out of all places, in a country, in the only democratic country in the entire region. And one might be critical of the of certain aspects of Israeli governmental behavior, but nonetheless, it's the only bona fide democracy we have over there, and it just goes to show how foolish church people can become when they dabble in areas of which they have no control and of which they know nothing.
A symbolic gesture, this is the last topic we're going to take up here, right, during our Religion Roundup, a symbolic gesture that we've talked about several times before, Uwe, has to do with a certain piece of art called Our Lady of Kazan that's been, if I'm not mistaken, in the possession of Pope John Paul II and his predecessors for quite some time. It's going to be returned to whom and for what reason?
Yeah. Well, it's been in the possession of the Pope, this particular Pope, not his predecessor. It's an icon that was especially precious to the Russian Orthodox and was carried by Russian troops before the Communist Revolution as a protector, as it were, of Russia. And It then disappeared from Russia at the time of the Russian Revolution, showed up in North America, was bought up by a Catholic organization that then took it over to Fatima in Portugal, which is a sort of Marian site of pilgrimage, and was then handed over to the Pope when he went to Fatima, and it is currently still hanging across from his desk in his private apartments in the Vatican. He initially, you know, the Pope's intention is to advance or speed up reconciliation with the Orthodox churches. In fact, that has taken precedence over his ecumenical moves with Protestant churches, simply because it turned out that many of the Protestant churches were not had different things in mind than he did, and were much more secular-minded in many ways. Anyway, he said that the first priority is now reconciliation with the Orthodox, from which Rome had been separated since 1054. And he had fared relatively well with the Greeks and, of course, with the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, who is the spiritual leader of Orthodoxy, though he is not a pope by any means, but he is a spiritual leader of world Orthodoxy. But the one bunch of Orthodox that are not playing ball here are the Russian Orthodox, and in fact, he couldn't actually bring the statue, the icon, over to Kazan as he intended to, and now he's handing it back in order to convince the Russian Orthodox, or help convince the Russian Orthodox, that he means business by reconciling with them as well.
With only 30 seconds before we have to go and wrap this up, will we see some kind of real reconciliation between Western and Eastern Christianity, the Roman Church, the Eastern Church, Orthodoxy, and the Pope's Church? Will we see that within the next decade or 20 years?
Oh, definitely. I don't know to what extent the Russians are prepared to go along with this, but the Greeks and the Romanians and some of the Ukrainians and others, definitely. I mean, there is some form of reconciliation going on, and there's a great desire to reconcile. There are enormous differences over issues that we have differences with the Catholics as well as Protestants, for example, the question of the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin and then other things. But yes, I think we will see a reconciliation between the two.
Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. He joined us from France this afternoon for our religion roundup. Uwe, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much, Todd.
When we come back from this break, we're going to turn our attention to a Christian philosopher, mathematician, Blaise Pascal. Now, you've heard about Pascal's wager, haven't you? Or at least you've heard something of it. It's more in the interest of the self-interested man to opt for the existence of God than it is for him to opt against the existence of God. Why? Well, of course, if God doesn't exist, you've lost nothing. If God does exist and you opt against his existence, you perhaps have lost everything. That's called Pascal's wager. We're going to be talking a little bit more about the thought of Pascal, not with regard to God, but with regard to man, when we come back.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Does prayer bring God to me? Is prayer a pipeline of communication between a believer and God? And is that pipeline a two-way street? You'll find answers to these questions in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August, Is God Listening? It's written by Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Andrew Steinman. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Is God Listening? Costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Does God decide how to answer requests based on how many people are praying? Find out with the book Is God Listening by Dr. Andrew Steinman. When you order, tell them, I listen to Issues, Etc., and I want the book of the month for August. The title is God Listening? issuesetc.org or 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Now that Congress is out of town, the president says he'll make 20 recess appointments to a broad range of positions, including the head of the Federal Trade Commission and the ambassador of Estonia. Stuart Shepard has the story.
The appointees were nominated by President Bush in the fall and spring. The nominee to head the Federal Trade Commission had specifically been blocked by Democrats. So the president bypassed Senate confirmation and moved them on through.
We all know that the Senate has been slow in confirming the president's nominees, particularly for some of the judicial positions, but for a lot of these other positions as well.
Trent England with the Heritage Foundation says this is also a way for the president to remind the senators of his authority.
Particularly where you have a minority of the senators who have really hijacked part of the nomination process, the Senate confirmation process, the president may have a constitutional duty to use the recess appointment power.
That's especially important with more than 10 judicial nominees being held up by Democratic filibusters.
There are those extremists on the left who are willing to put an ideological litmus test apparently onto any appointment and try and stop the president from doing his job.
Kay Daly is with the Coalition for a Fair Judiciary.
Everything we care about, from the sanctity of traditional marriage to abortion, to even property rights, will end up in the federal court somehow, somewhere. So it matters who puts on those black robes.
She says the president needs to have those positions filled. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard.
Because these are recess appointments, the terms will only run through the end of 2005. The president earlier struck a deal not to make recess appointments of judges through the end of this year in exchange for quick confirmation of a number of uncontested nominees. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
When you survey the body of Christ today, one thing that you are struck by is the disunity, the fractured state of the Church of God. We're going to talk about unity in the body of Christ next time when we delve with Ephesians chapter 4 on the Bible study with Pastor Joe Cox. Join us. The Bible study is heard weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Does God communicate to us in prayer? Find out with our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August. It's titled, Is God Listening? By Dr. Andrew Steinman. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. Is God Listening? An in-depth study on prayer. 1-800-325-3040.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. In about 25 minutes, open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll be talking about some of the research we just discussed with Uwe Simonetto during our Religion Roundup, and in particular that Barna research. And then also, this is it's not so old. It's only about a week or two old, a survey that the Protestant majority in the United States is on a trend to disappear. It hasn't disappeared yet, but the Protestant majority is on a trend to disappear. Here's something from another piece of research that, if I get to it during open lines, I'd be anxious to share with you. The number of unchurched adults in the last 10 years. What do you expect? I mean, there has been such an emphasis on the unchurched. I mean, that's a term I have yet to find anyone who can define it for me. We used to talk about unbelievers. Now we talk about unchurched. Well, if you would expect, with all the emphasis on reaching the unchurched and focusing on the unchurched in the last 10 years, that that number of unchurched people in the United States would have diminished. It hasn't. In fact, it's doubled. It's doubled in the United States. The largest growing religious group in the United States in surveys are the none of the aboves. They're not Christian. They're not Jewish. They're not Muslim. They're not Buddhist. They're not anything. They mark none of the above. They are the fastest growing religious group. They're not atheists or agnostics. They have a category too. Fastest growing religious group in the United States. We'll talk about that during open lines. Your questions and your comments. And as usual, since it's the last live hour of open lines coming up in 25 minutes, anything you want to talk about, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. For the next 25 minutes, Robert Velarde joins us. He is pursuing graduate studies in philosophy at Denver Seminary. We're going to be talking about Christian philosopher, mathematician, man for all seasons, Blaise Pascal, not on so much on Pascal's wager, for which he is famous, but for the 17th century man for all seasons view of man himself, man's greatness and man's wretchedness. Robert Velarde is co-author of a book called Examining Alternative Medicine. He's also written an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Greatness and Wretchedness, The Usefulness of Pascal's Anthropological Argument in Apologetics. Robert, welcome to Issues, Etc.
It's great to be on, Todd.
Robert, I'm a firm believer in total depravity. I'm a Lutheran pastor. But I'm always quick to point out that that does not mean that fallen man is always as depraved as he can possibly be at every moment in time. I think that total depravity is borne out by the observation of the human condition. But you see these unexpected acts of civil righteousness. 9/11 is one that you cite in your article where you see the worst and the best of man. It doesn't disprove man's depravity, but it does show that man, and I think Pascal would concur, is a big paradox. Tell us about this.
Well, Pascal himself was Roman Catholic, but he actually had some affinities to Augustine. He was associated with what was called the Jansenist movement in the 17th century, which was sort of a reform movement within Catholicism that was reacting against the Jesuits of the time. And Pascal really had a lot of affinity for some of Augustine's ideas, including man's corrupt nature, that we are so fallen that traditional arguments, what we'd call natural theology for the existence of God, such as from the creation or from the design of the universe itself, really weren't enough to reach into that fallen nature. So Pascal said, well, you know, let's not use those arguments. Let's try to develop some kind of philosophical, psychological approach. And what he saw in human beings was a contradictory nature. We exhibit qualities of greatness. We can do great things. But we also can do wretched things, very horrible things. And he says, well, what can explain that? And his solution is, well, only Christianity can explain that adequately. Therefore, Christianity is true.
So this is an argument, an apologetical argument.
Yes, that's right. Pascal actually intended to write a work of apologetics, and of course by that we mean a defense of Christianity, called An Apology for the Christian Religion. He didn't finish that. He passed away when he was 39. He was suffering from various illnesses. But he made a bunch of notes, and he collected all these notes, his family did, after he died, in a book called Pensées, which in French means thoughts, his thoughts. And throughout these thoughts, we get not only his famous wager argument, but we get what has been called the anthropological argument, this argument from human nature as a argument in favor of Christianity. And he did feel very strongly that this was a way to confirm whether or not Christianity is true, if it can explain this better than any other position.
So we're really talking about, as we look at all of the various, the term of the day, of course, is worldviews. If we look at all the worldviews, which one corresponds most closely to, and which one explains, in the best way, reality as we see it around us?
Right, and in the way Pascal put it, he said our greatness and wretchedness are so evident that the true religion must necessarily teach us that there is in man some great principle of greatness and some great principle of wretchedness. And we can apply this today. We can test different worldviews. We can look at humanism that says we're great, we have a lot of human potential, or we can look at views like nihilism that really end in despair, or other worldviews that say, well, there's not really any hope for us. We're so depraved, we're so twisted. So we have two competing views here. And Pascal, the way he put it, he said, man is neither angel nor beast. And he offers what in philosophy we call a tertium quid, which basically means his solution to this problem of how come we're great and as well as wretched is, well, it's sort of a mixture of both, but it's different. It rests upon the fact that we are created in the image of God. We still have the capacity for greatness, but we are fallen. So we have the capacity for wretchedness. And I point out that example several in my article. One is the whole 9/11 events. You know, we have the rescue teams going in, exhibiting greatness. We have the wretchedness in the act of terrorism itself. And then we look at this on an individual level as well. We can look in the arts. I give examples of writers, of philosophers, of musicians. that in and of themselves they exhibit qualities that are both great, such as composing great works of music, or wretchedness. You know, I give the example of Carlo Gesualdo, who was an Italian composer, who was a murderer as well. So we have this conflict, and Pascal says it needs to be explained.
Before we get there, set the context here. You talk about Pascal's shock treatment. He's dealing with the French nobility, and he's trying to deal with kind of the ultra-rational mind of his day. What is the shock treatment, Pascal?
Well, basically, the term itself was Bernard Ramm who came up with it in reference to Pascal's theory of reasoning in this argument. He called it existential shock. The people of Pascal's day, a lot of them aren't much different than people of our day. They were skeptical. They were very reasonable people. They were diverted a lot. Some of them were indifferent to Christianity, something we get today in the postmodern attitude that sort of says whatever. And Pascal said, well, we need to shock some of these people out of this complacency. They need to know that there is an element of wretchedness in them as well as greatness. And one great famous quote of his, Pascal writes, what sort of freak then is man? How novel, how monstrous, how chaotic, how paradoxical, how prodigious. He goes on to call human beings feeble earthworms, a repository of truth, sink of doubt and error, glory and refuse of the universe, which we might translate today as the glory and garbage of the world.
So he's basically requiring not his opponents, but those to whom he is trying to make his apologetic, to deal with the world such as it is.
Yeah, he is not using what we'd call an inductive argument or a deductive argument. He is using what we would call philosophically an abductive argument, abductive. Appeal to the best explanation is what it is. It's something that is used really in science a lot, the appeal to the best explanation. And Pascal says, given the facts, given the evidence of history and of man's propensity for wretchedness as well as greatness, what is the best explanation? And he says Christianity is. It is created in God's image, the fall. However far-fetched some of these beliefs might seem to a skeptic, he says, well, give me a better answer. And humanism attempts to give a better answer. The New Age movement attempts to give a better answer, and other worldviews do as well. And Pascal would reply, well, those answers are inadequate. Christianity's is better.
How do you respond to someone who says that what Pascal is basically doing is kind of arguing around and around in a circle?
Well, basically what you have to do is you've got to look at the argument itself. You know, on the surface it might seem, well, Pascal is just appealing to the Bible that says, well, we're fallen, we're created in God's image in order to prove the Bible. But it's really a more complex argument than that. It is, like I said, abductive in the sense of a scientific method sort of approach. He says, all right, here are the facts. Let's look at history. You know, we look at that today and we'll say, well, what have we done historically? We've had the trench warfare of World War I. We've had the Nazi Party trying to exterminate the Jews in World War II. We've had millions were killed under the communist China rule under Mao Zedong. How do we explain that condition when we look at it in a greater context of our capacity to do great things like works of art or architecture or literature, you know, in the Christian and non-Christian realm? And he says, let us look at that. Let's examine the evidence, and let's try to figure out what gives the best answer. So it really isn't a biblical argument per se. It is more an examination of the evidence and an appeal to what is the best explanation for what the evidence is that we have.
In a way, it's akin to the same kind of argument that intelligent design makes with regard to a creator or an intelligent designer.
That's a very similar approach that you get from people like Philip Johnson and William Dembski and others that have said, you know, similarly, how best do we explain what we see around us? Is it intelligent design, or is it a random chance situation? And I get into that a little bit in my article, not too much, when I discuss humanism and how humanism might respond to this argument by saying, well, you know, we're just evolved beasts. We have this wretched nature because it's just left over from our evolution, and we're great just because we have evolved brains that are very advanced.
Well, let's talk about humanism. How does humanism explain the what seems to be the self-evident paradox that is the human condition, that man, in terms of earthly matters, has the capacity to do great evil and the capacity in the civil realm to do great good, and sometimes uses both capacities, his greatness, to do evil? How does humanism explain that?
Well, you know, humanism itself, there are some similarities among humanists, but it really depends on the humanists you're dealing with. Some might say, well, there really is no such thing as moral evil. You know, we are trying to do the best we can for the good of our community or society or because it's a positive thing to do. And others might say, well, yes, there is evil, but they don't go further than that. They don't offer an explanation for where they get that. Whereas someone like C.S. Lewis said, you know, how does one call a line crooked if one has no idea of a straight line? In other words, there has to be some sort of standard for morality. So humanists have kind of approached it in different ways. Some would say, you know, it really doesn't matter. You know, we do what we do because we're trying to get by as best we can in this life. That's all there is. All we have is this existence, so we may as well cooperate in order to try to make it the best we can. But they really have no explanation, really, for this whole greatness and wretchedness concept. Even the concept of reasoning itself does not make sense in a humanistic sense because, as other philosophers have argued, in order for reason to even be considered something accurate, you know, how do we get some kind of reasoning that's accurate out of something that's produced by chance and time? Our very reasoning abilities are in question if that is the solution that humanism offers.
So it is, as one of our guests, Dr. John Ward Montgomery, is fond of saying, the humanist will often borrow on Christian capital unknowingly in order
right.
to make his arguments.
Yeah, and actually I think it was Francis Schaeffer who first kind of put it that way. He said other worldviews have to borrow capital from Christianity in order to take a stand, you know, either morally or in different aspects. Otherwise, you have no basis for claiming something is right or something is wrong. And Pascal basically says, well, we do have this evidence. Christianity explains it best. The fact that God exists explains the existence of absolute moral values. So it's a better explanation. And he you know, continues to offer similar arguments as well in Ponce's, like the wager, which is one of his more well-known arguments.
We're talking with Robert Velarde. He's pursuing graduate studies in philosophy at Denver Seminary, co-author of the book Examining Alternative Medicine. He's also written an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Greatness and Wretchedness, the Usefulness of Pascal's Anthropological Argument in Apologetics. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, we've got about 10 more minutes left in this conversation. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. To kind of put a bow on the humanist or the naturalist worldview, if someone says man is merely the product, he's just a beast. That is, he is the product of a biological process that is blind and undirected in any way, and we are just the latest in the what will inevitably, a long string of things that will come next, but right now, all we are the products of this biological process. Is there any accounting there for the wretchedness or the greatness of man?
Not really. What you really end up with, I think, if you follow a worldview such as humanism to its logical conclusion, you end up with nihilism, which basically says is a worldview of despair. Nothing matters. There is no right and wrong. There is no absolute truth. What's the point? You know, sort of the existentialist question that Camus and others asked is, you know, why shouldn't I kill myself? What is the answer to that question if you don't have a basis for anything other than this random chance and existence that's going to end as soon as you die? It's really a very desperate situation that people are in. And Pascal says for people that are like that, he says, if he exalts himself, I humble him. That's the kind of situation that the humanists are in. If he humbles himself, I exalt him, I go on contradicting until he understands that he's a monster that surpasses all understanding. And really that is, again, Pascal's existential shock, getting people's attention on what really matters. And these questions that are very high-stakes matters, if Christianity is true, if there is an eternal hell, These are very important questions, and people need to understand that.
We've come in the postmodern era, where truth is considered relative, morality considered relative, everything considered relative, to kind of apatheism. It's not atheism, it's not agnosticism, it's not anything, it's apatheism. You said before, the credo is kind of whatever. How does Pascal's anthropological argument speak to that?
Well, what he does, he writes a lot in his Pensées on the topic of indifference. He writes on diversion. You know, why is it that we're always involved in some kind of diversion? And Pascal tries again, you know, psychologically to appeal to people. And he says, well, why are you indifferent? Why is it that you are seeking amusements and things? Isn't it because if you had some time to consider these greater questions, you would realize that within yourself there's something very wrong, that things aren't the way they should be. And yet we have some sort of yearning, as Augustine may have put it. You know, we have this yearning that really can't be fulfilled unless God steps in. Pascal is often quoted as, you know, calling this the God-shaped vacuum. What he really said was, since this infinite abyss can be filled only with an infinite and immutable object by God himself, in other words, there is something lacking within us that if people were given the time to contemplate that, they would realize that within themselves.
So for today, when we have people who hardly think past the end of their own nose, and yet they fancy themselves deeply interested in matters spiritual, what's the special utility of Pascal's argument based upon man for today?
Well, one good point that Doug Rodheis makes from Denver Seminary, he talks about human beings today. He writes that there's great interest in the soul and human potential and spirituality. He says people may doubt the existence of God, the reliability of the Bible, or the deity of Christ, but they know that they exist, and they desire to understand themselves, their pain, and their possibilities. So what I think we have to do is appeal to that psychological level, or what we might call a prudential level of interest, something that's very practical. You know, why is it that that people are that way, that they are seeking something to fill their lives with? And I think if you spend enough time dialoguing with people, they're going to admit, or you will find something that they are trying to fill their lives with. And what you need to do, I think, is just ask them questions, as Christ did. Appeal to their sensibilities as to what do they think they are. You know, what? Not so much the question, what makes us tick, but why do we tick the way we do? And I think that is what Pascal is trying to get at.
So as a tool in the apologetics toolkit, what is the role of Pascal's observations about man? Where would you put it among all the other tools that the apologist is going to use when dealing with the skeptic? He's going to be there trying to kind of smash the smug skepticism of the skeptic. What kind of a tool is it?
Well, I think it's one of many tools and arguments that Pascal put forth. I don't think he ever intended this to be, you know, the main argument of his defense of Christianity. It's sort of one of many. And what Pascal would do, I think, if someone, say, didn't respond to this type of argument, is that he would move on to something else in their lives that he thought might appeal to them or get them to talk further about this kind of thing. He might move on to the wager argument, saying, you know, isn't it better that we bet on God if he exists because of the high stakes involved and the consequences than we don't believe? Or he might move on to biblical arguments. He called it scripture and the rest, different lines of argumentation. I would put this as one tool, one approach to reach certain kinds of people, maybe postmoderns, maybe humanists, maybe New Age or nihilists. And then if you don't seem to be getting anywhere, you pray about it and you move on. There's a number of arguments for Christianity. Some are more effective with people than others, and I think we need to be aware of a variety of them. And the anthropological argument is just one argument among many that I think has a certain appeal to people that are maybe more introspective about their condition, and Pascal, I think, really reaches out to people like that.
Robert, does it surprise you that the observations of a 17th century mathematician and philosopher, short-lived man, but obviously great contributions to the world of thought, that his observations about mankind would be as useful as they are to us today, especially for the Christian apologist in the 21st century?
Yeah, I think it's pretty amazing testimony to our condition and how similar we are actually to ages past. We tend to get what C.S. Lewis called chronological snobbery. We seem to think that our age and our technology and everything that we have now is better or more advanced than what was in the past, whereas some of the greatest thinkers of history were in the past. And the fact that we are all human beings and experience the same things is just amazing that Pascal tapped into these insights and that we have what he's left, basically, these fragments, in a very raw form, just notes that he would scribble on what we might consider scraps of paper. And his ideas that apply to us today, I think, is a testimony to the fact that the human condition has not changed. We have maybe developed more advanced ways of diverting ourselves, but the root issue is still there, and it's still the same as it was in Pascal's day.
Robert Velarde is pursuing graduate studies in philosophy at Denver Seminary. He's co-authored the book Examining Alternative Medicine and written an article in the most recent edition of the Christian Research Journal titled Greatness and Wretchedness, The Usefulness of Pascal's Anthropological Argument in Apologetics. Robert, thank you for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd.
I got a letter, and we were doing a conversation, some hour of issues, et cetera, all runs together for me now, and I got a letter from someone out in California recently. A listener, I don't know what their circumstance was at all, but they were, and they, I think by the end of reading this one-page letter, I was pretty much convinced I was dealing with an atheist. They were talking about the existence of God and an all-good God. I think we'd been talking about the problem of evil or something like that with one of our guests. If God is all-good and all-loving, then why does evil exist in the world? You know, there was an interesting answer to that question given once, and I heard someone say, look, before we blame God, the person who asked that question is assuming that God is either absent or non-existent, right? So before we blame God for the existence of evil and therefore rule him out of existence, why don't we deal with the people who are on the scene? Us. I think the answer to that question does not lie in God, but in us. Why is there such great evil? Well, let's deal with the people who are actually on the scene causing the problems before we rule God out of existence because he permits such evil. And even though the atheist, the skeptic who says, look, God can't exist because if he were all loving, he couldn't permit all this evil. Here's the evil, ergo he doesn't exist. He's not only cutting off the branch that he's sitting on, but the atheist is still left with the question, then why is the evil here? And it still comes back to around where it belongs, in the wretchedness and fallenness of man. When we come back from this break, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. The last live hour of open lines this week on Issues Etc. Give us a call during this break. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.
After almost a century advocating civil rights among minorities, why would the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People choose to endorse legal abortion?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The abortion industry targets urban neighborhoods. One in three pregnancies among African Americans ends in abortion. Abortion destroys the rights of the weakest among us, the unborn. This new pro-abortion policy of the NAACP does not help the minority community. It only undermines the inherent dignity in each and every individual, regardless of race or state of dependence. The NAACP should be working to uphold that dignity.
The Susan B. Anthony List is dedicated to supporting pro-life legislation
training candidates and activists, and promoting pro-life leaders. To view all this month's commentaries, visit our website at sba-list.org.
I'm Todd Wilkin, host of Issues Etc., talk radio for the thinking Christian, weekdays 3 to 6 on AM 850 KFUO, Clayton, St. Louis.
AP Network News, I'm Tim McGuire. Investigators in Salt Lake City say Mark Hacking talked with a, quote, reliable citizen witness during his time in a hospital psychiatric ward. The Sheriff's Department says Hacking told that witness that he killed his wife while she slept. Meanwhile, the search for Lori Hacking goes on each night at a local landfill. Correspondent Mark Thiessen reports.
They are searching the landfill overnight because of the heat during the day, and it just becomes too hot for not only the handlers but also the dogs. What police have been doing in this case, they've been starting about 10 o'clock every night and going to about 4 or 5 in the morning.
Lori Hacking has not been seen since July 18th. Hurricane Alex remains a dangerous storm, but it's one that's moving away from the coast after brushing North Carolina's Outer Banks. Correspondent Aaron Beard reports from Buxton, North Carolina, that he and others are being kept inside a hotel right now.
There are some people sort of wandering around the lobby in the area. Others are pointing out debris that's kind of floating around, or even a trampoline that has been blown into a telephone pole over near the Atlantic Ocean.